Today's Teisho will be on case 19 in the Blue Rock Collection, Iyen Lu, the Hikigan Roku. Case 19 is Butei's One Finger Zen. Engo's introduction. Even when one particle stirs, the whole universe is involved. A blossom opens and the world responds. But what do you see when no particle stirs and a blossom does not open? It is said that it is like cutting the thread on a reel. It's one cut and you cut them all. Or it is like dyeing the thread on a reel. Dye it once and you dye all of it. Now, if you eradicate all the complications that affect you and bring out the treasure within you, you will find that everything is all right, above and below, before and behind. If you have not yet done so, see the following. Main subject, Gute, whenever he was asked a question, only raised a finger. Secho's verse, well now, I like Gute's way of answering. Who could compare with him throughout the whole universe? He let down the wooden float in the dark sea, making the blind turtle sink and swim and cling to it. Here it is, it's August. August. And we took our little walk outside. It was just glorious, wasn't it? Just incredibly beautiful. Last night, coming here to the Zendo, I drove by a family of deer, and there were four little fawns. It was a group of deer. I don't know if they really have families, but a group of deer, and four little fawns, and the fawns were so happy. I mean, it was, the fawns were so happy, they were prancing around. It was so cute. They still have their spots, and they have long legs. They seem to be all legs. And the parents, or I assume they're the parents, were just calmly eating and looking around. But the fawns were so happy, and they were making idiots out of themselves. You know? And as I was driving by, one of them just sort of jumped into the air. I think another one had startled it and just ran into the bushes. It was just so wonderful. And then last night after the sit, we all came out, and the sound of the life, you know, the sound of the insects was deafening. It was so beautiful. And I have to say that it's beautiful no matter what, but after sitting last night and walking out and hearing it with a purified mind, it was just glorious. And also today, our little walk, after sitting for a while, you go outside and you just walk slowly, you see the shadows on the ground, you hear the insects, and you hear the wind rustling through the leaves. And there's something about it, isn't there, that's It's something haunting and powerful about that. Ordinarily, our minds are so muddied, so distracted, that these sorts of events pass us by almost unnoticed. In fact, you know, the ordinary person is constantly in search of heightened stimulation. You know. So this is why people have, on my way to the Zendo yesterday also, I was driving through Piscataway and I stopped at a traffic light. And the guy next to me had his music on so loud that I was deafening even to me in my car. And I just thought, how can he stand that? But I think people become addicted to more and more stimulation. It becomes more and more important to get more and more inputs, you know. And I believe, personally, that that doesn't really enhance the quality of the experience. That strangely, taking inputs away has the effect of making any particular event or any particular moment of awareness very rich and powerful, I think. Sometimes things happen and they seem trivial. But sometimes things happen and they seem to have a kind of, it's as though a door is about to open. I don't know if you've noticed it, but sometimes events will happen and it's as though a door is going to open. It's like something exciting is about to happen, or that's the only way I can put it. You know, there's something about the moment that's gripping. And that's powerful, and we don't always know why. You know, we don't always know why this is so. Perhaps you have had events in your life that at the time seemed trivial, but later they stick with you for years and years and years, and there's something almost haunting about them. Yeah. I can think of so many events like that that at the time just seemed utterly unimportant. And then later, you know, here it is 40 years later or 35 years later, and they're still deeply moving to me. When I was young, when I was just out of college, I had read Jack Kerouac's On the Road. And so I wanted to hit the road. America was rather a different place. In fact, it was quite a different place from what it is now. And people were, I think, much less fearful and also somewhat friendlier. And it was possible to just walk out to the road, and if you found a major road, and you could hitchhike, you know. And this was an acceptable social practice in the 60s and 70s. In fact, some countries actually issued hitchhiking licenses. The United States didn't do it, but the thought was that why not give somebody a ride if he needs a ride, and if the issue is safety, you could have a license. I think the Canadians were talking about doing that, and some countries in Europe did that. But anyway, you couldn't hitchhike on the interstate in most states, but you could. You could get on the interstate entrance, for example, on an on-ramp, and you could have a sign that said Chicago, or you could just stick your thumb out, and somebody would pick you up. And I went all over the country this way, without any money to speak of, you know. And I can remember being stranded. The good part is you got to go across the country for free, but the bad part was that somebody could let you out in the middle of nowhere, and you could sit there for forever, you know, it would seem like. And I remember somebody letting me out in the Southwest. I guess it was in New Mexico. And I was on this road where he let me out, and I didn't see another car for hours. And there was a tree, a cottonwood tree is what it's called, and it has big leaves that shimmer in the sun, and it's very common out west, so it's very hot, and there's this tree with a deep shadow, and there was a horse under the tree, and there was a fence around the field. So I was sitting by the road, and this horse was looking at me, and I was looking at him. And he was eating, you know. And nothing special, you know. But this morning when I was sitting, I remembered that, you know, after 35 years, it's still moving. You know, I wish I had gone over and given that horse a big kiss, you know, because I love that horse, you know. But why is that so? Why do I remember that event? You know, what is it about that event that was so special? I can remember earlier, again, this is such an ordinary event, but still I remember it. You know, I used to work construction in the summer. Back in the 70s, college tuition might be $1,500 a year. That's hard to believe, isn't it? But it was possible back then for me to earn my whole tuition for the year by working a summer job. And so I had a summer job which paid pretty well. It was hard work. It was working construction. So in those days, people were building so much that when I got out of college at the end of the I mean, when I got out of the, when the school was over at the end of the spring semester, I could get a job within a couple of days, just driving around to construction sites. And it was hard work. You know, we used to have to carry shingles up onto the roof of apartment buildings where they were putting roofs on. So a bundle of shingles is quite heavy. I think I couldn't get up a ladder now with one bundle, you know. I really would, I'm not sure I would make it, you know, but back then, I used to carry them up all day. That was my job, just I'd put a bundle on my shoulder and I'd go up the ladder and dump it on the roof and then climb down the other ladder and back up. Anyway, I had jobs like that. I was working with a friend of mine, Larry Sullivan. He was coming to pick me up, and I was standing by the road outside. This is a town called McLean, Virginia. So I was on my way to a big city that was really springing up. And I was sitting by the road, and there are these flowers. You'll see them here in New Jersey too. They're really called weeds, but they're quite beautiful. They have scrawny looking plants with green stalks, and at the tips of their stalks they have these bright blue, actually they're not really a bright blue, they're sort of a powder blue flower. Those are called chicory flowers. And I was standing there waiting for my friend, and all of a sudden I looked at this chicory flower, and I felt this real sense of like well-being. It was just amazing. I just felt like I could just, you know, sort of like blend into the flower. And then my friend came and he picked me up and we worked all day and so on. But even now, why do I remember that event? And, you know, everybody has these events, right? Where there's just something about them that makes them powerful and haunting, and we don't know why. They're not the ones we expected, you know. I mean, I remember going to the Grand Canyon for the first time, when I was hitchhiking. I was hitchhiking out west and I wanted to see the Grand Canyon because everybody sees the Grand Canyon. And I got to the Grand Canyon, and the Grand Canyon is, it was quite a disappointment for all kinds of reasons. For one thing, the Grand Canyon has a massive parking lot right next to it. And it has all these campsites. And in fact, there's even a Safeway. Isn't that a shame? There's even a grocery store right next to the Grand Canyon. So I was disappointed. I was expecting to have this experience where I would be out in the natural world with very little interference. And there was a Safeway, and people were driving their motor scooters around, and I was walking by campsites where people were watching TV, you know. So I was kind of disappointed, and I got to the end of the Grand Canyon, and I looked it over, and it was like, oh yeah, yeah, the Grand Canyon. So it just, nothing happened, right? And I've had other times like that too, where I remember my graduation in college, you know. I didn't sit around dreaming about my graduation ceremony, but I did think it would probably be a very special day. And for some people, it is a special day, but I remember getting up and going to my graduation, and it was just nothing, right? They were just, the president of the university was on a podium, and he was just reading names. And he would go Smith, Simpson, Smith, Spellmeyer, Scora, and we would just go up and get the diploma. I don't think he even shook our hand. I think we just walked by, he grabbed the diploma and moved on, you know. And even if he had shaken my hand, I don't think I would have gone, oh, this is the day, you know. I work as an English professor, you know, and when I first got to Rutgers, the department chair called me into his office, and he sat me down and he said, I want you to know that you are, at the end of 5 years, you're coming up for a tenure review, and if you don't have a book and 4 articles, you're out of here. And he said it just like that. And he said, I don't want you to have any illusions about this, no matter how good a teacher you are, you know, if you don't have the book and you don't have the articles, you're going to be out of here. So I left the room, and I went back to my office, and I thought, well, it's too late to pack and go back to Seattle. And I came out here to New Jersey. I said I'd take this job. So I worked like the devil to get tenure. You know, I mean, I worked so hard. And you know, I would wake up sometime and think, you know, I could see my chairman's voice. I could see his face and I could hear his voice, and he'd say, or you're out of here, you know. He's retired now, fortunately. Everybody was afraid of him. But I was afraid that the day would come when the chairman would walk down the hall and go, sorry, kid, but you're out of here, you know. So I worked very, very hard. But you know, I did get tenure, which is a wonderful thing. But the day the chairman, it was a new chairman, fortunately, and he came down and said, kid, you're not out of here. The day that happened was just like any other day. I didn't go, oh, this is wonderful, you know. Oh, finally. In fact, I was so busy, it was like, yeah, yeah, you know. Yeah. So it's like the day where I was sitting by the road and I couldn't get a ride all afternoon. And I was frustrated, and I was teed off, because I wasn't going to get to my destination anytime soon. I was stuck in the middle of nowhere, and I was sitting there thinking, why did I take a ride with this guy? Why did I, you know, it's boondocks out in the middle of nowhere, I'll never get a ride. And then then the wind blew through the leaves of this tree, and the shadows on the ground, you know, flickered, and a horse eating grass caught my eye, and I remember it with this deep sense of happiness and peace, you know. No diploma, no raise, you know. Somehow, there's the events of our lives that really mean something, maybe I shouldn't say mean something. Maybe that's a problem, you know. There's moments, I think, where we connect with the world. You know, it's just like something inside of us connects. And it's not, they're not necessarily the moments we get to pick. They're not moments we get to choose, because the moments we try to make special often don't turn out to be special, you know, no matter how hard we try. And the moments where, you know, we're just sort of open. Sometimes something, it's like we're caught by surprise, and it's like this event just, there's like a boundary between ourself and the world goes away, and years later you can remember this, and it's just so powerful and beautiful, you know. I actually did stay at the Grand Canyon, and I hiked down into the valley, into the basin of the Grand Canyon. And at that time, the Grand Canyon was like a circus, right? Again, I had gone to the Grand Canyon stupidly, thinking I was going to have this experience where I would be, you know, alone with nature or something like that. And the Grand Canyon where I was like a theme park almost, you know. It's not that bad, but it was disappointing. And when I went down the trail, it was almost like a line of people going down the Grand Canyon, you know. So you certainly weren't alone. There were so many people you had to be, you know, it's like you had to wait some time. But after like the first couple of miles, people began to sort of drop away. And there was a place about 2 miles down where you could stop and people can rest, and there's water down there. And most people stopped there. And then I went on, and some guy was on the side of the canyon. As I went down the trail, I noticed some guy was on the side of the canyon, and he was playing a flute. And he was a really good flautist. And he was playing the flute, and it was, and again, this, if you had said, what do you want to have happen at the Grand Canyon? What I wanted to have happen was to have nobody there and go down and have this beautiful, uninterrupted experience of the natural world. I didn't want to run into some guy who was playing a flute. You know, that, if you had asked me, I would have said, that's very artificial. I don't want any music. I want to hear the you know, wind blowing through the canyon. But this guy was playing the flute, and it was breathtaking. And it was like, you know, my heart just lifted up. You know, it was so beautiful. You know, I didn't expect that, you know. It wasn't the moment I was looking for, but it was so beautiful. There's something about our relationship with life, you know, that I think we aren't always alert to, you know. We try to plan out life, and we have to do that, you know. We have to plan. We have to take precautions, you know. And we have to try to be like rational beings. So that means, you know, you put some money in the bank for a rainy day. You know, you make plans, you have health insurance, you know, those that sorts of things. And you have to make plans, you have to try, and if you do go on a vacation, there's nothing wrong with that, you know. But you could be on the vacation and the events that happen, which are really wonderful, might not at all be the ones you expected. And so, you know, there's like a disconnect between the way we think about life and the way life actually happens, you know. I think that it's very difficult for humans to be open to life. It really is. My feeling is because, you know, the way we try to do that is very artificial. You know, it's very, you you know, get all your friends to come to your party, and you spend days preparing it, right? And you cook the best food, and they all come, and the magic just isn't there. You know, you planned it so carefully with such good intentions, but the magic isn't there, you know? And you could run into somebody one day on the street and say, hey, do you want to have lunch? And you go to lunch, and it's the it's the best thing that ever happened to you, you know? That actually happened to me. I've had many birthday parties, like most Americans. You know, my parents always wanted me to have a birthday party with cake and so on and so on. And when I was backpacking around on one occasion, I suddenly realized, oh, this is my birthday, you know. And this was in New Mexico, near a place called Coronado State Park, which is on the river, the Rio Grande River. And I was feeling, it was my birthday, and I sort of realized, gee, it's my birthday, and I'm all alone. Nobody's celebrating my birthday, you know, this sort of thing. Anyway, I walked into town. I can't remember. I think this is Bernalillo. I think the town is called Bernalillo. And I said, you know, is there a good restaurant around here? And somebody said, oh, yeah, there's a great restaurant. And there was a little hole-in-the-wall Mexican restaurant. And it was, I'm not kidding, that was the best burrito I've ever had in my life, you know? At this time in my life, I used to drink, so I also had a beer, you know, and I'd been hiking and backpacking, and I was going to meet up with some of my friends a few days later up in northern New Mexico. But I was staying at the Coronado Park, and I walked into town and said, is there a good restaurant? And they said, yeah, go to this place. And it was that burrito. I mean, I still remember that burrito, you know. I can't really taste it, but I remember that was the best birthday I ever had, you know. I walked out of that restaurant, you know, in the summer, and the, you know, beautiful. It was just a beautiful moment. So I think the way we live, the way we try to live good lives or rewarding lives or enjoyable lives, is really destined to produce a lot of frustration. You know, it really is. This idea that we can plan out life and make things happen. You know, you can be happy on command, or you can be you can make those feelings, that moment where you feel deeply connected. You can make that happen. That's just, I think, profoundly wrong. And our whole culture is based on this idea, right? The amusement park model of reality, you know, or the mall, the shopping mall. I mean, some people love to shop. And actually, I think there is a zen of shopping, you know. So I'm not going to criticize it. You know, and indeed, I think some people shop and they're just shopping and they find things unexpectedly that are exciting. So I'm not being critical of shopping, you know, really. But for me, going to the mall has always been kind of like a sad and depressing experience. I know it's not for everybody, you know. And I know people have a lot of fun at theme parks too, you know. So I don't mean to be too rough on Disney World and things like that, which I've never been to. But on the other hand, you know, I think there is something false about the theme park view of life, you know. You get your promotion and you go back and you know what? It doesn't feel any different. I was reading this article a number of years ago, and Ted Turner was in there, and it was the subject of the article. And I believe it or not, I actually like Ted Turner because he spent literally hundreds of millions of dollars to save the environment. He owns a huge ranch out in New Mexico, and he bought all this land, and he restored it to its natural condition, and he turned it over to the Wildlife Conservancy. and it's thousands and thousands. So, you know, he's, I think he's a good guy. He was interviewed by some reporter, and he was talking about his life, and he said, yeah, he said, the day I got my first billion, he said, it was kind of a disappointment. And he said, I went home, and I said to my wife, honey, I just broke a billion. And apparently one of the kids was crying and was like, yeah, you know, please, I'm busy right now, you know. And there was nobody he could talk to about it, you know. And then he said he sort of sat down and he thought, well, what, you know, really this is no big deal, you know. It's just a billion, right? So, you know, there's something to that though, right? You know, you get your diploma, you get your promotion, and it's not the contact, you know. So, you know, Zen practice is a different way of living. And it's so important to see Zen as a way of life, you know. I mean, people come here and practice for a while, and then sometimes they decide that Zen is not their thing. And if that happens to people, I understand. I mean, that's fine. But some people do this for a while and they realize this is deeply satisfying. And I think those people should just realize that you know, Zen is not about you come into Zen, you meditate like hell, you have Daikensho, and then you can go on to something else, right? And that's the model, right? That's what people have in their heads. Yeah, I made my first million when I was 30. I had enlightenment when I was 40. You know, I ran for governor at 50. You know, I've pretty much done it all, right? You know, that's not how it is. You know, I mean, you don't have to sign up for a lifetime. You know, but this is a way of living, right? It's a way of living. So it's not something that any experience is going to bring to a close, you know. So I have been doing this from the time I was 23, something like 22 or 23 years old. And I swear to you, you know, I can't wait to do my Zazen. You know, I love it. And a lot of Zen practice is just standing by the side of the road waiting for a car to pick you up. It's just like hitchhiking, you know? It really is. I don't think you can hitchhike anymore. I really don't. First of all, I don't think it's safe for you to hitchhike, necessarily. And also, I myself would be worried sometimes. I see people who are on the side of the road, and I wonder, you know, I'm not sure I would pick that person up. So I don't think the world of hitchhiking is available right now, maybe at some future time. But hitchhiking was really good preparation for Zen, you know. Because you get up in the morning, if you're hitchhiking, you want to get up early because you don't want to miss your ride, right? I mean, I've hitchhiked from Washington, D.C. to San Francisco. And I've gone from Seattle to Washington, D.C., and I've gone from Seattle to Albuquerque, New Mexico many times. In fact, I used to be able to get from Seattle to Albuquerque in 4 days. Yeah? Day one, Montana. Day two, southern Wyoming. Day three, southern Colorado. Day four, Albuquerque, New Mexico. And that's in time for lunch, right? You know, so I'm actually a very good hitchhiker. You know? But in fact, I'm probably a better hitchhiker than I am anything else, you know. But the art of hitchhiking, and there's a real art, is you have to be accessible, right? You do. Hitchhiking is just like that. You get up in the morning, you think, oh my gosh, the sun's coming up, you know. And you could lie around, but then you think, I could miss that ride. That could be the ride that takes me to Montana, right? So you get up, you might not even have time for breakfast, and you get out there on the side of the road and you stick that thumb out, right? Usually I had my backpack, you know. And you know, you sit, and you can't make it happen. You could get out there at the crack of dawn, nobody, nobody picks you up, right? You could smile, you try to look charming, you know. You can have, I used to have like a goofy hat that I would wear. It was very disarming, right? It was like a tennis hat. So people would see that and think, oh, that guy looks so goofy, I'm sure he's okay to pick up, you know. And it worked very well. It was a very good hitchhiking hat, you know. And I always introduced myself, you know, yeah, I just got out of college, I went to school here, blah, 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 you know. And I'm just trying to see the country, you know. And, you know, and people pick you up partly because they want you to be an interesting conversationalist. So it's not fair to get into somebody's car and go to sleep, right? You have to, you know, say, hey, where are you going? You know, where are you from? You got any kids? You know, blah, 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 you know. And so anyway, you want to get up, you want to get that ride, and you're out there, and, you know, hours can go by. It's just really, hours and hours, you know, and nothing happens. And you can get so, you know, you can get so bummed out. You go through all the usual things. You think, oh, damn it. You know, I got out here early. Poor me. You know, this is so life is so unfair, you know. What a waste of time. Why didn't I just take the bus? You know, I should just take the bus. This is such a stupid way to travel, you know, blah, blah, blah. And then after a while you think, okay, well, I'll try to make the best of this. I'll try to put a good face on it, you know. Nice sky, you know, it's pleasant enough today. And after a while that wears off too, you know. Finally, you're just in the moment, you know, without any judgments or expectations. You're just sitting there, you know, just totally sitting there. And you might get a little ride and you might get a big ride. It might be the ride that takes you to Montana, you know. And it's like, oh, wow, you know, Montana. You know, that's how it would be like hitting the jackpot, right? It's like, you're going all the way to Butte? All right, you know? And I would meet such interesting people. You don't meet those people necessarily on the bus, and you don't meet them if you have your own car. You know, I would meet the most interesting people, and I would meet people who were so kind. They'd say, do you want to stay? You know, do you have a place to stay? Do you want to stay at my house? You know, he'd say, do you have money for food? Oh my God, they were such kind people, you know? And you met some characters, you know, some really screwy characters, you know. But it was so interesting, you know. But you had to get used to being standing by the side of the road waiting for that ride, you know. And there's a hitchhiking mentality, right? You know, it's a hitchhiking. This next ride could be the ride. So you have to be available. You're out there. You're standing by the road, you're waiting for something to happen, right? And then eventually it does. And it could be nothing. It could be the ride of your life. It could take you right across the Golden Gate Bridge, you know, on a beautiful day, you know? So meditation is just like that. It's, you sit on the cushion and you're by the side of the road waiting for the ride, and the ride may not come this morning, you know? And you might have the ride of your life, and it's just fantastic, right? Yeah. So this is how we Zen people live, right? We know we can't make it happen. We know that, you know? You can do it all right. You can get plenty of sleep, and you can say, okay, I'm going to get up Saturday, sit. I'm going to go to bed tonight for once. I'm going to go to bed early, get up, you know. Usually I'm hungry, I'm going to have a little something to eat. You get on the cushion, you know, this is the right pillow. And I found this is my pillow, I pulled it out of the pile, it's the perfect, this is not too thick, not too thin, you know. And nothing happens, right? And it could be the other way, you know, you didn't get enough sleep, you were working hard, you went to bed, you were too keyed up when you got home, you stayed up until midnight, you get up and your ass is dragging. You throw yourself on the cushion and your stomach's growling, and it could be fantastic, right? And knowing this, this is how we Zen people live, right? This is how we Zen people live. And I think it's a wonderful way to, I think it's the best way to live. You can't make it happen. You have, being open to the moment, requires a lot of patience, willingness to wait, and just see what turns up. But I think these moments we have in life that are really alive, those are the moments that happen when we're in this state. When we're in this state, you know, we're just patiently waiting, and something wonderful happens. Right? I think there's so much power in that way of life. You know, there's a book out by a guy named Rick Warren. He's a minister, and he's a very nice man. He's a liberal minister, so he's not one of the bad ministers. He's not one of the, you know, he's a liberal, good human being, and he has a book out called The Purpose-Driven Life. And I think that's a good book, but someday, I will never do it, but I thought I'd love to write a book called The Purposeless Life. Right? And I think that's a better life, personally. I really do. Purpose is okay, but I think a deeper life is beyond purpose. You see, because there's something about that title I think is very revealing, The Purpose-Driven Life, right? I mean, I think we're all a purpose-driven, you know? But if you look at it, if you think about it, you know, so often our purposes don't necessarily produce the results we intended, you know? So, I mean, once upon a time, there was a man named Henry Ford. And he heard about an invention in Europe. It was called the automobile, the self-moving automobile, self-moving. No horse. See, this is amazing. No horse. And believe it or not, you can burn distilled petroleum, which is extremely cheap, right? Yeah. And Ford thought, well, that is a fantastic idea. You don't even need a horse. There's no horse droppings to clean up. You don't have to buy hay. You know, you just get some petrol, some distilled petroleum, and you put it in the car and you can drive around. The only problem is, you know, ordinary people can't afford this. So he said, I know what I'll do. I'll build millions of these. You know, the purpose, right? Beautiful, beautiful. But look at what has happened. I mean, actually, the worst thing that's happened in the 20th century was the invention of the car, right? Now, you know, we do have to have purposes, but it didn't quite work out the way he planned, right? So I think we need to be like a little suspicious of our purposes. You know, we can't really see that far ahead, right? We can't. My personal feeling is that life is more complex than our little mind, and you know the one of the places I hitchhiked through was the Hoover Dam in Arizona, and it is a beautiful dam, and it's an engineering marvel. But you know what? It destroyed the ecosystem of the river, of the Colorado River. It destroyed it, totally. And so, you know, again, our purpose, not necessarily, getting what we want is not necessarily a good thing, in my opinion, because we can't see far enough, and life is a little too complex for our yes and no mind, you know. Believe it or not, you know, they were going to actually flood the Grand Canyon. Do you know that? It almost happened. Somebody had the wonderful idea of putting a dam at the end of the Grand Canyon, and it was only through a very narrow congressional vote that the Grand Canyon wasn't flooded. So if things had turned out a little differently, when we went to the Grand Canyon, it would be full of water, and people would be motorboating on it today. Now, I think that would be a great pity. And in fact, you know, Lake Powell, which is one of the big lakes out there in Arizona that was created by these dams, loses more water than it saves. Isn't that interesting? So it was a disaster in terms of water reclamation, actually. So you know, we just can't know. You know, sometimes not getting what you want is not such a bad thing. It's not so bad, because we can't see very far. Purposes are necessary, but you know, we can't really know what's best sometimes, even for ourselves. So I think there's a deeper way to live, which is beyond purpose, the post-purpose life, right? And the on-driven life, on-driven, you know. So that's really what this is all about, the Zen way, you know. It's very beautiful, just patiently waiting, and when something happens, it really happens. You know, you didn't make it happen. It comes right out of the universe. It's beautiful. So, Gute, whenever he asked a question, only raised one finger. Well, let me just tell you so you don't get the wrong idea. If you come in, if you're working with me with this koan and you hold up your thumb like you're hitchhiking, that's not the answer, okay? So I just wanted you to know that. But it is like hitchhiking, see? It is like hitchhiking, very much, you know. You don't know what's going to happen, but you just present yourself over and over again. And when it happens, it's absolutely wonderful. And you know what? Ultimately, it happens all the time. You know, if you stay in this life long enough, this life of patiently waiting, it's like these moments happen more and more often, right? Because more and more often. Every moment is really this energy, this force, this haunting energy that seems to be there sometimes. It's there all the time. It's just we're not open to it. If you're practicing today, I hope you're practicing in 50 years. The most important thing is, you know, this is about, you know, in a certain sense, it's very important. Zen is about enlightenment. It's about waking up. But you know, it's very important not to just be practicing to have enlightenment. It's very important to see this as a way of life. And it's very important to love your practice. See, if this is like a bitter pill you have to take, please try to get beyond that mentality. You know, if you say, well, I don't like sitting that much, but when I have Daiken Sho, I'll do something else. And I don't think that's a good way to practice. There actually are people who practice like that. It's a terrible thing. You know, they just, you know, I'm in it for the big explosion, and then I don't really like it that much, but it's something I have to do. And I don't think that's a good spirit for practice. If you are on the cushion and you've got your thumb out and you're waiting for the ride, there's moments where you think, why am I doing this? This is so dumb. You know, why didn't I take the bus? But sometimes you get picked up when you're on the cushion, and it's just fantastic, right? And you're so happy to be alive. And just keep practicing. Those moments will happen more and more often. And eventually, you'll just love your practice. You'll even love waiting by the road. Even waiting is great. Because you know what? Even if you don't get a ride, you feel so good. You know, sometimes you come in and you sit down on the cushion, and you don't get the wonderful buzz, you don't get the rush, you don't make the connection, but you get off the cushion and you know what? You're calmer, you're more relaxed, you're happier, you know? And that's worth a lot, right? And try spending 40 or 50 years that way. It's a really beautiful way of life.